formulation, where we started out with the Hamiltonian formulation. And remember that the Hamiltonian formulation was fine for going to quantum mechanics or to quantum field theory, because once we have variables and their conjugate canonical momenta, then we can impose commutation relations and quantize. The trouble was that the Hamiltonian formulation singled out the time variable over the space variables, and that is not manifestly covariant. So that makes it very hard to guess from this stage, from this formulation, what the general relativistic formulation would be. So we performed this step. We applied the Legendre transform and arrived at the Lagrangian formulation of the Klein-Gordon equation. This is nicely covariant. It's treating space and time just the same. But we had a price to pay, which was that we no longer have conjugate pairs of variables. We can't quantize the usual way doing it this way. However, the benefit is that it's manifestly covariant. And so now today we'll perform the next step, which is to go from special relativistic covariance to general relativistic covariance. And from that point, we can then go two different routes. We can either do a Legendre transform back to a Hamiltonian formulation, now within general relativity, and this is the path that we will take. And from this Hamiltonian formulation, where we then have pairs of conjugate observables, so variables again, we can do the quantization relatively straightforward along the lines we did before. Well, or we can start from the Lagrangian formulation within general relativity and perform what Feynman did, Feynman quantization. And that gets us to this point. And it can be shown that this formulation is equivalent to that formulation. Well, obviously, otherwise it would be wrong. We will also do this, but I will today only give you at the end of the hour a brief indication of how that works. And we will properly treat that at the end of the course. Most of the course we will do this way because it has some distinct advantages. The main advantage is that this way of doing things, going through the Hamiltonian formalism, will allow us to study the vacuum state. Normally, the Feynman path integral approach to quantum field theory, and by normally I mean most applications outside cosmology, normally this is by far the preferred path of doing things, because you can derive things completely covariantly and very quickly, and you get those Feynman rules that are very elegant. It has one big drawback, though, which is that it tells you nothing about the vacuum. It doesn't tell you how to choose the vacuum state. Whereas this way, we will have a handle on that. It will still be non-trivial, but at least we have a handle on this. And obviously, the notion of the vacuum is essential on curved spaces. So we performed step two. Remember that was, we will perform step two, this part here. So we will go from a special relativistically, obviously covariant formulation of the Klein-Gordon equation to one that is general relativistically covariant. We had started with step two already. And to that end, we wrote the Klein-Gordon action. This is the action functional for the Klein-Gordon field. So you take a Klein-Gordon field, which is a real valued function of space and time, and you plug it into this expression here, and out you get a number, a real number. That real number is the action for that field. This is the formulation that is correct for any inertial observer that sets up a rectangular coordinate system. If you work with a polar coordinate system or the observer is accelerated, then that would be the wrong expression. You actually get the wrong number out of it. By the way, V of phi and a little phi is here potential. We don't even specify what it is. Could be anything, really. Normally, it's assumed that it is a polynomial or at most a power series in those fields phi and little phi. What the potential does is it describes how our Klein-Gordon field is interacting either with itself, if it contains in the potential the field itself, or how the Klein-Gordon field interacts with other quantum fields, which might be described by the little phi. In the very early universe, it looks today, according to the evidence, like it was completely dominated by a Klein-Gordon field, which is very convenient because it's the the simplest kind of field one can imagine. So that in practice, we will most of the time neglect those potentials, or at most we will look at potentials that contain only the Klein-Gordon field itself. Basically, the idea is that in the very early universe, those other fields were present, but their contribution to the energy and momentum was very small compared to the tremendous contribution that the Klein-Gordon field would have had in the very early universe. So the other fields were not really suppressed. They just did the normal thing they always do. It's just that the Klein-Gordon field would have had a tremendously much larger, by many orders of magnitude, much larger energy and momentum, and therefore much larger interaction among itself and also with gravity than any other field. So we will in general assume now that the potential takes this form where it's just some polynomial in the field, for example, phi to the third or phi to the fourth, which means that those harmonic oscillators that are in this field are coupled with each other. So it's a self-interacting theory. Those Klein-Gordon particles don't just pass through another like photons would, but those Klein-Gordon particles actually interact with another when they encounter another. That's what this potential would say. But again, for early universe cosmology, while it was originally thought that the phi to the four term is necessary, it now looks, according to the evidence, as if it's not necessary. Apparently, we get away with just having a phi squared term, and that we wouldn't even list as being part of the potential. We would view this as being part of the kinetic term. So then we said, well, this is all fine to write the Klein-Gordon equation in a way that the Klein-Gordon action in a way that is valid for inertial observers that use rectangular coordinate systems. But then the restriction to rectangular coordinate systems is really very serious because on a generic curved spacetime, there is no such thing as a Cartesian coordinate system, as a rectangular coordinate system. You can't put a chessboard pattern on a sphere, for example. There just is no way to make it match. It just won't work. And this means that independently of all the other things that we already know about, like curvature and so on, it's clear that any approach that would rely on having to work with rectangular coordinates just can't work. We have to free ourselves from that constraint of having to use rectangular coordinates. And we did that already in the last class. We freed ourselves from that constraint of having to work with rectangular coordinates. While still staying within special relativity, we allowed ourselves to use any arbitrary coordinate system. And the solution that allowed us to do this was to write the Klein-Gordon action in this way, which looks relatively similar to the formulation in rectangular coordinates, but notable change is that this is no longer the E term mu nu. This is a generic matrix G mu nu, and here is the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of that matrix. Remember that the single bars here mean two things. They mean taking determinant and taking absolute value. We showed that this expression gives you the same number no matter what coordinate system you choose. Everything's still in special relativity. So you can calculate the action of a field even in polar or spherical coordinates or whatnot. And that means that you can also derive the Euler-Lagrange equations in any coordinate system you wish. And they describe the same physics because you derive them in the same way. You extremize the action with respect to variations of the field. So this is in itself already useful. But of course, our interest in this is that it is the starting point for generalization to general relativity. Now here the key point for going to general relativity is the consideration of what matrices G, or matrix valued functions G, can occur here. Okay. Yes. Well, that's true. Strictly speaking, this is one particular way of doing it. And we are here subscribing without me mentioning it, because I don't want to assume that everybody has taken the previous term's course. We are assuming here that we choose in the cotangent tangent spaces always the canonical basis that comes along with the choice of coordinates, which we don't have to. But if we do, then this is how it looks like. Things would look rather different if we formulated everything in a tetrad formula. But I think it would take too much of a review if I wanted to do the tetrad formula. Thank you.
If we did do it that way, then we had to go with the first.
Yeah, because the reason is ultimately that the Hamiltonian formalism, any way you slice it always, it just treats time specially. So let us look at what those matrix valued functions G mu nu could possibly be. Remember that when we discussed that in the last class, we found that whenever you change coordinate system, the G mu nu matrix generally changes. It doesn't always change. If, for example, you start with a coordinate system of an inertial observer, a coordinate system that is rectangular, and then you go to an observer that is also inertial and also has a rectangular coordinate system, then the matrix G mu nu actually doesn't change. It is in all cases eta mu nu. But if then you go to an arbitrary coordinate system, something wavy, or perhaps accelerated, or both, then the G mu nu will turn out to be a rather complicated matrix that includes all those subtleties that you know, for example, from changing integration variables in multi dimensions, where you get, when you go to spherical coordinates, you get those factors of r squared, sine theta, and so on. All of that comes about from this, from the non-trivial metric. So one can ask, by trying out arbitrary coordinate systems, completely arbitrary coordinate systems, can we get completely arbitrary matrices G mu nu? So if we start with a Minkowski space and then allow ourselves to perform an arbitrary, very wild change of coordinates that implies acceleration and rotation that are both position dependent and time dependent. So the most wild thing you can do, you will definitely get a very complicated matrix valued function G mu nu of x. Always symmetric, it's guaranteed, but it could be very wild. And then the question is, can you get all matrices G mu nu this way? And it turns out you cannot. If you start out with the flat Minkowski space metric, you can't get all possible 4x4 matrices in this way. And you can also ask, if you're given a metric function, G mu nu of x, so a matrix valued function of space and time, how can you find out whether or not there is a change of coordinates from Minkowski space to some other coordinates such that the metric takes that form that you were given? This looks like a hopelessly difficult problem, because you would have to try out all possible changes of coordinates. But it turns out that that problem can be solved. I'm just repeating here that if you work with Minkowski space and rectangular coordinates, then G mu nu of x, of course, is supposed to look like this. And when you change to an arbitrary coordinate system, then the metric changes from eta mu nu to G tilde mu nu, which is given by the original eta and then multiplied with those matrices. Since this is symmetric and those are the same matrices, you end up with another symmetric matrix here. So the questions that I raised was, we notice that GMU is always a symmetric matrix. Can any arbitrary function obeying symmetry, can any row of mu nu occur as a GMU that you get by a suitable change of coordinates from an ether mu nu? And the answer is no, you cannot. And this leads us to curvature. There are metrics that are not reducible to the Minkowski metric, and they will correspond to space times with curvature. Curvature in space and curvature between space and time. And curvature between space and time is what? Any intuition for what that might be? You see, curvature between space and space coordinates is sort of plausible, but what is curvature between the space and the time coordinate? Any intuition about it? But it's expansion or shrinkage. That's what the curvature is, as we will see later on. So for example, in cosmology, it's often a good description to say that space-time is spatially flat, mostly flat, and the only curvature is between space and time. And that's the expansion. All right, so in order to introduce curvature now, in order to move to general relativity, we continue to postulate the coordinate system independent Klein-Gordon action of above. Remember, this is true in any coordinate system in Minkowski space. And now we will allow arbitrary metric tensors g mu nu, arbitrary matrix valued functions g mu nu of x, subject only to the following conditions. We will allow that there does not exist, that do not exist coordinates in which this matrix valued function reduces to this constant matrix valued function. We will allow that. But still, we will require that at any point x naught of the manifold that we may choose, there always exists a change of coordinates such that at this point, the metric g tilde mu nu of x coincides with the special relativistic metric. Now, why would we want that? Well, what that ensures is that locally, special relativity holds. This is the requirement of the equivalence principle. In this way, we are postulating that gravity can always locally be eliminated by a suitable choice of coordinates. For example, by going into a free-falling accelerator, you locally don't see the curvature. Everything is as if there was no gravity. So we assume that if a freely falling observer in a small region sets up a rectangular coordinate system, for example, somebody in a freely falling elevator, poor guy, then the observer will see arbitrarily small gravity effects. Namely, if the observer makes the region that he's setting up his coordinate system in arbitrarily small. See, that qualification has to be made. Because you could be, for example, very close to a very strong source of gravity. You could have, let's say, if this thing here was not 300 grams heavy, but, I don't know, like 3 billion kilograms heavy, then it would be really strong gravity. But not only would it be attracting everything in its neighborhood to it. The point is that there are tidal forces too then. Because points that are close to another would have significantly different forces acting on them. Just like the moon, for example, is subject to significant tidal forces that make it show always the same face to us. See, the side of the moon that is closer to Earth in principle wants to orbit at a different rotational frequency than the side that is further away from us. And that leads to enormous stresses. And it turns out that if the moon was much closer than this, it would rip it apart. But it's in a safe distance. And the forces just keep it locked, actually, always having it face the same side to us, which is probably the reason why it took people so long to understand what the moon is and what the other planets are, because they didn't see a reason why a celestial body would always show us the same side. Right? If it was just some sphere up there, why would it not rotate on its own with such arbitrary frequency? Anyway, how did we get to this point? All right, so yes, strong tidal forces. So the thing is now that if this thing was very heavy and there were strong tidal forces, therefore, for example, this hand being pulled in this direction, but that hand being pulled in that direction, and there's an angle in between, and there's a significant difference in the forces if the force overall is strong enough. So if I wanted to set up a local coordinate system that is pretty much mimicking special relativity, then not only would it have to be free falling, but also it would have to be small enough so that those angles don't matter. Of course, for originally, this is not how Einstein thought of those things. Originally, he thought of the equivalence of inertial and the gravitational mass of objects. He said that, well, look, they all fall with equal velocity. How come? After all, that depending on their mass, the gravitational attraction increases or decreases, and so also the resistance to a change of velocity. How come they are exactly proportional? And of course, the fact that they are exactly proportional allows us to go into a free-falling coordinate system. Otherwise, we couldn't even think of a free-falling coordinate system, because what would be free-falling for a feather would not be free-falling for a pen. So this is historically how this consideration came about. So how then do we identify curvature? Assume we are given a metric tensor, g mean u of x. So we are actually given a 4x4 symmetric matrix as a function of space and time that has this property that locally we can always find a coordinate system so that it becomes the eta mu nu matrix. Then how can we determine whether or not this is the metric tensor of a flat space-time? How can we determine whether or not there is a coordinate system such that everywhere this is just the eta mu nu matrix? Now, this problem is solved in differential geometry. And to that end, one defines the so-called Christoffel symbol functions, which are these. Now, we don't have time to go into exactly why those. but let me show you the mechanics of how these things then work. So here's the metric tensor. And as I said, we are already given those. We assume that somebody gives us this 4x4 matrix valued function. Then we can calculate its derivatives. These commas, remember, mean derivatives. So this is g alpha nu of x differentiated with respect to x index beta, and so on. And the g mu nu with the upper indices is the inverse matrix at every point. Then these are the so-called Christoffel symbols. And what are they good for? Well, the Christoffel symbols can be used to define another, even more complicated quantity, namely the Riemann curvature tensor, which is this expression. It contains derivatives of the Christoffel symbols, as well as quadratic terms in the Christoffel symbols that don't have derivatives. Now, what is the meaning of this Riemann curvature tensor? Well, it turns out one can prove the following. The Riemann curvature tensor tells us exactly when there is curvature and how much curvature there is and what kind of curvature there is. It is in one-to-one correspondence to all curvature properties of the manifold. Now, what is curvature anyway? Curvature can be defined in several different ways, but the most intuitive way, perhaps, to define curvature is to say that curvature is present if parallel transport is non-trivial, if parallel transport of vectors and tensors is non-trivial. This means the following. A space is called curved at a point x if the parallel transport of a vector v, so at the point x of the manifold, choose a tangent vector v, and then parallel transport it in the direction of a vector eta, and then parallel transport it in the direction of a vector nu, and then parallel transport it back in the direction of eta, and then parallel transport it back in the direction of nu. If you do this, you end up with a vector again in this point. So they live in the same tangent space. The starting vector v and the vector that you ended up with bringing over here. And that would be v prime. If the space is flat, then, well, you've parallel transported. So v prime is v. And if the space is not flat, then v prime points in a different direction. So a space is called curved if the parallel transport of a vector v along an infinitesimal parallelogram, this one, returns the vector v prime to x, and v prime is a rotated version of v. The Riemann curvature tensor tells us exactly how much the rotation is going to be between v and v prime. Namely, the difference vector v and v prime between v and v prime has the following components. This is the A component. It's given by taking the Riemann curvature tensor at the point x in question and then contracting the first two indices with the two direction vectors eta and nu. And then once you've done that, once you've contracted those indices B and C, you're left with a matrix R that has an upper and a lower index, and that's a rotation matrix. It rotates the vector v that you started out with to give you the difference. It tells you what the difference is of v prime and v. So it tells you the rotation that v underwent. So the rotation is v plus that. And now, just to make you alert to the fact that curvature is not necessarily what you imagine intuitively to be, let me just point out this. If you take something like this and you bend it like that, this doesn't confer any curvature to it. This is not curved. According to our definition here, neither will R be non-zero. No, it will all be zero. It will all be zero, all components. And also the parallel transport will be trivial. Try it out. If you just bend such a thing like that, it doesn't affect parallel transport. So if in doubt, always retreat to the definition of curvature as non-triviality of parallel transport. Now, in principle, it could also happen that the parallelogram simply doesn't close. Right? I mean, there could be something going wrong if you take an eta and then attach a nu. Remember that the nu is attached here, not there. Okay? So something could go wrong when you take the eta, plug it right here, then take the nu, which in principle, yeah, you know, that's have it start an infinitesimal distance from the x. Go here and then take the eta, but actually you're applying the eta over here rather than attaching it over there. So it's something could go wrong. And in principle, it could be that parallelograms don't close. So you don't even arrive back at the original point. When that happens, we say that the manifold has torsion. And that would manifest itself in in order to describe that, we would have to augment that. We would have to allow for an extra contribution to gamma. The gamma that we have here is always automatically symmetric in alpha and beta, just because of the way that alpha and beta occur in this, over here and over there. It's completely symmetric. But if you augment that definition and allow for an anti-symmetric component, then that's what it would do. It would introduce torsion. But there is no evidence of torsion in nature. Therefore, we will neglect it now. But do keep in mind that people didn't just dismiss it as quickly as I'm doing it now. In fact, Einstein spent years on this, and a lot of other clever people spent years on studying whether torsion could have some effect. Einstein thought it might be electromagnetism, but it's not. But still, it's something that the mathematics definitely allows, but nature doesn't seem to make use of, which is in any case non-trivial, because in principle, if we've learned anything from quantum theory, it is that whatever is in principle allowed, nature will try out, at least virtually. Right? So I think it's sort of plausible that if there's nothing that explicitly forbids it, nature would at least play with torsion in a quantum mechanical sense. So here's the proposition then. The proposition is that the curvature tensor captures everything there is to know about curvature in the sense that we asked about before. Namely, the following proposition holds. If in region A, the curvature tensor is actually zero, then it is guaranteed that there is a coordinate system such that this complicated 4x4 matrix that somebody gave you actually reduces to the eta mu nu matrix globally. Not just at a point, not just individually at each point there is a coordinate system that will achieve it, but globally it is possible. Which is a good indication that we got the right definition of curvature. The one that doesn't recognize this as curvature. Basically, what this means is that, you see, when you do that, you may wonder, why is it that you don't recognize this as curvature? Well, you see, it's not intrinsic to the object. If I bend it, I basically do something about the embedding of this two-dimensional manifold in the three-dimensional manifold. The embedding changes. But intrinsically, for an animal that lives in that surface, nothing actually has changed. No distances have changed. No angles. All triangles still have a sum of 180 degrees. See? And of course, what we're really interested in is curvature intrinsic to the manifold in question, not curvature related to how the manifold might be embedded in a higher dimensional manifold. We want to consider curvature in itself. I think that was the big deal that Gauss and Riemann were all about. They wanted to characterize the properties of the manifold itself independently of how it might be embedded or might not even be embedded in higher dimensional space.
If you can go from one manifold to another by a diffeomorphism, then it is indeed they will have the same curvature. Like in this case, we are.
Well, you see, when you say Riemann manifold, think of a diffeomorphism as a change of coordinates, and that's just like a change of clothes on a person. It doesn't change the person at all, right?
Well, like I'm talking about the piece of paper, like a
yeah, I mean, if you take the piece of paper, oh, I see. If you do the bend, if you do the bending, well, that's not a diffeomorphism. That is a change in the embedding in the higher dimensional, three dimensional space. So what then is the dynamics of space-time? Which are the degrees of freedom of curvature for which we will have to find an equation of motion? Well, we saw that the curvature of space-time is encoded in that matrix-valued function g mu nu, which then codes for gamma, and which then also codes for the curvature tensor. And then we saw that if you're given a non-trivial g mu nu of x, a matrix-valued function which has wild entries, complicated functions as entries, then there can be two distinct reasons for why this thing looks so complicated. And that is a major problem in the general relativity and especially in the quantization of general relativity. The reason why a matrix-valued function g mu nu of x can be very complicated is either that space-time has maybe no, or just a little curvature. But we've just happened to choose a really unfortunate coordinate system. Space-time may not be curved at all. It might just be Minkowski space. But if you let a child choose the coordinates, it could be complicated, very complicated. So the complexity of the matrix elements of the metric function don't really give you an indication as to how non-trivial the space-time might be. But then the second reason why the coordinates might be very complicated is that space-time is indeed curved, and there may not exist a coordinate system in which the coordinate, in which the matrix elements look any simpler. So there may not exist a coordinate system in which g tilde mu nu is eta mu nu, or close to it, no matter which coordinates we choose. And this makes it really complicated to work with general relativity. And that's because the situation is just very much more, it's less transparent than with a field. If you had an ordinary field, like a Klein-Gordon field, well, if the Klein-Gordon field is constant, then it is constant. That's all there has to be known about it. If the Klein-Gordon field takes very complicated amplitudes, goes up and down very wildly or whatnot, then this is how it is. What you see is what you get. You know that the field is having some complicated structure. If you look at the function, it is complicated. Not so with the metric. It can look very complicated and describe a flat space-time. So it's very hard to pin down what the degrees of freedom are in the metric, because much of what makes up the non-triviality in it is merely choice of coordinates. It's like choosing clothes on people. It's not changing the person. And so it's not changing the space-time, what coordinate system you put on it. But obviously, there is no point in quantizing choices of coordinate system. It would be like quantizing names of particles. this is not a degree of freedom, not a physical degree of freedom. There's only a point in quantizing the actual degrees of freedom, the actual curvature, the actual shape of the manifold. Now, one might think, all right then, just take the matrix element of the Riemann curvature tensor. The thing is that they too are redundant to some extent. They have more components in there than there are degrees of freedom in gravity. And that's, that you can see, because this is not scalars. The matrix elements of the Riemann curvature tensor depend on which coordinate system you choose, which means that a lot of what's going on in that thing, if you look at it as a matrix with entries, a lot of that is actually just mere choice of coordinates. So we can't just take those guys and quantize those. We would be inadvertently also quantizing mere coordinate choice, degrees of freedom. So here's a strategy then. Obviously, we'll have to work with scalars, because scalars have no coordinate system dependence. And they're the only things that don't have coordinate system dependence. So the idea is then to make use of the fact that the action principle also works with a scalar. So the strategy will be, we use the degrees of freedom of curvature to build a scalar out of them. And then, since it is scalar, we can build a coordinate system independent function, which can act as the action for gravity. And then we use this function to derive the order Lagrange equations and the equations of motion. So we need to define a scalar out of curvature. Well, we have one tensor already, and that's the curvature tensor. It's a four tensor. It has four components. And the next step is to reduce that number to two components. The Ricci tensor is obtained from the Riemann curvature tensor by contracting those two indices. And you can verify that this is the only thing you can do, actually, to go to two indices. Of course, well, you could do other things, but you would either get the same, or you would get zero. And that's because there are lots of anti-symmetries. For example, mu and I are two indices that are anti-symmetric. And this means that you could as well contract here between I and mu as the same thing, really, up to a minus sign. But if you contracted those two, for example, with the metric, then that would just give you zero. So that's the only thing you could do. And it turns out that when you calculate the Ricci tensor out of the Riemann curvature tensor, that you are losing information in this business. And we will come back to what information we are losing here. If you only know the Ricci tensor, you cannot reconstruct the curvature tensor. Which is to say that if the Ricci tensor is strictly zero, a situation which is called Ricci flatness, or space-time is Ricci flat if this is zero, if that is the case, if the Ricci tensor is zero, then it is still possible that the curvature tensor is not zero. That's very important. This difference between the Ricci tensor and the curvature tensor, the fact that it contains less information is very important in physics. Because the Ricci tensor is the only thing that directly occurs in the Einstein equation, as we will see in a moment. It doesn't occur directly in the Einstein equation, but this one does. So the Einstein equation is sort of oblivious to certain things that are encoded in here and not there. Well, it's not exactly oblivious, but we'll see exactly what it means. So we can ask then, what do space-times look like that don't have Ricci curvature, space-times for which this is zero, but that is not zero? But it turns out that these are space-times with gravitational waves. It's very similar to electromagnetism, where you have homogeneous solutions, which would be electromagnetic waves that do not need sources on the right-hand side. Now that we have the Ricci tensor, we can contract its two indices, which is fortunately possible because they are not anti-symmetric, to obtain the Ricci scalar, or the Riemann curvature scalar. You may ask, is that the only scalar that we can build? No, you can actually build plenty of scalars out of the Riemann curvature tensor and the metric, not just this one. Let's see what we have. The simplest scalar that you can build is taking the metric and its inverse and contract them. That's a covariant thing to do. And you always get 4. That's not very useful, is it? You see, why do you always get 4, by the way? Yes, exactly, because that's the inverse metric to this one, right? And then it's a 4x4 matrix, so you always get 4. You get the trace of the identity matrix. Then what other scalar can be formed from the Riemann curvature tensor? Well, one is the Ricci scalar, but then there are many other scalars as well. And you may be interested in all those scalars because they will encode different kinds of information. This clearly doesn't contain as much information as the Ricci tensor does. And the Ricci tensor doesn't contain as much information as the curvature tensor. For example, this could be zero, but the Ricci tensor may not be zero. But even if that's zero, there could be other scalars that are not zero. So you can, in principle, build up the information about the manifold and its curvature through scalars alone. But what are these other scalars? Well, those scalars have to be made out of the metric and out of higher powers of the Riemann curvature tensor and out of, well, with powers I also mean Riemann curvature tensor and its covariant derivatives and their powers. So you can have expressions like this, expressions like that, and so on. So the gravitational action, the action for gravity, is then in principle of the following form. Well, the full action for everything is of the following form. S total will depend on the metric, it will depend on our Klein-Gordon field, and it will depend on all the other fields that there are in nature. So we will have a Klein-Gordon action. We already wrote it down. We will have an action for all the other fields, and I will not bother writing them down because qualitatively nothing new happens, and for the very early universe cosmology, we seem not to need that. And we need the gravitational action now. Now, the gravitational action a priori looks like this. It's got to be something expressed in terms of scalars that you can build out of the curvature. The simplest term is a constant. In principle, it's this number 4 times something. And then up to, then you get some coefficient that is undetermined so far, times the Ricci scalar, plus some coefficients, and then higher order terms, such as Ricci times Ricci and covariant derivatives of the curvature tensor, suitably contracted with the curvature tensor, and so on. Now, comparison with experiment within classical general relativity shows evidence only for the first two terms. We have evidence for this term, evidence for that term, but no evidence for those other terms. This means that the gravitational action, as far as we can confirm it experimentally, looks like this. It is up to this coefficient here, which is fixed by experiment, just the integral over the first two terms. The C naught is 2 lambda, where lambda is called the cosmological constant, and C1 is 1 if we pull out this factor in front. In principle, we do expect that the higher order terms, you know, absence of evidence doesn't mean that there's evidence of absence. In fact, in practice, we expect that there really are higher order terms, and that's because of quantum field theory. Quantum field theory has this habit that when you do higher order calculations, it will produce all possible terms that are allowed by the symmetries of the theory, which means that higher order calculations in what is called renormalization really ought to, and in all circumstances that have been considered, will produce higher order terms. But when you look at the dimensional considerations, if you look at how many units of mass or units of length you need, how many powers of units of length you need to write down those higher order terms, you can deduce from that what the units of length would be for those coefficients of C3 and C2 and the higher order coefficients. You may wonder, well, so what? And I know that this has to be 1/m^7 or what. What does that tell me? Well, don't use meters. Use natural units for that purpose. Use units in which speeds are measured as multiples of the speed of light. And use units in which actions are measured as multiples of h bar. And use other units that are composed of those and the gravitational constant, so that it is set equal to 1. And then you can ask, if I assume that those coefficients are not outrageous. So if I assume that they are not 1 billion or 10 to the 100, but roughly of order 1, that would be a natural assumption. If I assume that those coefficients come out of order 1 in natural units, then I can go back and calculate how big they would be when you use meters, kilograms, seconds, and so on. And you will find that they would be tremendously small. Those terms, just on the basis of unit considerations, would have to be expected to be very much suppressed. So it is not necessarily surprising that we see evidence only for these first two terms. It's because we would need a tremendously precise resolution in experiments to resolve those other terms. But there is very strong reason to believe that they are there. And of course, in extreme situations such as the quantum gravity of the Big Bang itself, these things could play a role. Not that people would really look much into it, but everybody has in the back of their minds that this sort of thing really could pop up there and should. Okay, so we have an action now. So for now, we take into account only the first two terms. So really that. This is our gravitational action now. And we can ask, what do we obtain now for the equations of motion? Remember, the gravitational action is just one action out of three. We have the Klein-Gordon action. We have the action of other fields, such as electrons, photons, and so on. And the gravitational action that we just wrote down. Then what do we obtain? We obtain three equations of motion. We take the full action, which you remember is the sum of three actions, and do the functional variation with respect to the external fields, I mean, with respect to other fields, photons, electrons, quarks, and that sort of thing, and set that equal to zero. That would give us the classical equations of motion for all fields other than Klein-Gordon fields. And then we also need to do the functional differentiation and set it equal to zero for the metric. Because we assume stationarity of the action with respect to changes in the shape of the manifold as well. And then C, finally, we also do a change, we also do a variational principle with respect to the Klein-Gordon field and set that equal to zero. Let us look at the outcome for each of those three cases. The first is we differentiate the total action with respect to the other fields. Well, that would be the classical equation of motion in this case. And this can be done in principle. And that gives us general relativistically covariant field equations, for example, for photons. Once we have them, then in principle, we can do a Legendre transform back to a Hamiltonian formulation, the main purpose being identifying the canonically conjugate fields to phi so that we can then impose the canonical commutation relations, built up Hilbert space representations, do Bogoliubov transforms, and so on. But we will not follow this here because we would really have to make choices and say, well, electron fields, or photon fields, or whatnot. And each comes with extra complications that are not of interest here for cosmology. So then B, we differentiate the total action with respect to the metric. There are some subtleties there, but the upshot of it all is that if we differentiate the total action with respect to the metric, then we obtain the Einstein equation from that. Keep in mind something very important. The total action consists of three contributions. There is the action of the Klein-Gordon field, the action of the other fields, and the action of gravity. And when you differentiate the total action with respect to the metric, then you might think naively, well, it's really only the derivative with respect to the metric of the gravitational action. But that's not so, because the other actions, the action of the Klein-Gordon field, the action of the other fields, all also depend on the metric. Because if you remember, every action, including the Klein-Gordon action, has the metric somewhere. It has the metric, for example, in the contraction of the d mu phi, d mu phi. It has the metric in the covariant integral measure, square root of absolute value of the determinant of g. So g occurs all over the place in the total action, not just in the gravity action. So we get, overall, two types of contributions from that equation. One contribution comes from differentiating the gravitational action with respect to d mu nu. That is the left-hand side. And then we get the derivative of the other parts of the action, the Klein-Gordon action and the other matter field actions with respect to the g mu nu. And that gives us the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. I mean, strictly speaking, of course, we have that this minus that is equal to zero. That is really this equation here. But if you put the terms ds by dg mu nu, where s is the matter action, Klein-Gordon and other matter action, if you put that on the right-hand side, then you get the Einstein equation out of this. So this is ds gravity by dg mu nu, and this is ds other plus s Klein-Gordon by dg mu nu. Not exactly, there's a prefactor there of 1 over 2 square root of determinant of G. But since it multiplies everything, it drops out of it all. So in essence, this is the derivative, this derivative, and that is this derivative here. No, I don't think so, actually. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I think I got that minus sign because, you see, it arose on the left-hand side with a minus sign, and then it's thrown over to the right-hand side. Thank you. Okay, so what is the team you knew? I mean, these things you recognize here. That's the cosmological constant, Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor, and so on, and the metric. But what is the team you knew? Well, the team you knew is just a name for all those terms that you get when you functionally differentiate the Tangordon and the other matter action with respect to team you knew. Then that stuff, whatever you get there, you call team you knew. It's the energy momentum tensor. Now, in the very early universe, apparently phi completely dominated the scene here. The Tangordon field completely dominated the energy momentum tensor. So for our purposes, we will now neglect the contribution from the other field, from electrons, quarks, and so on. Their contribution to the energy momentum tensor will be neglected. So the derivative with respect to the derivative of the contribution of the other fields, little phi, will be neglected. Then the functional derivative of the Klein-Gordon action with respect to the metric gives us a contribution here, 8 pi t mu nu. And that contribution, it turns out, is this. You see, this is all explicitly calculable here. These are just derivatives of the field. The metric tensor is given. Metric tensor here, field, field. So now, in principle, you might think, well, let's quantize the thing. Why not? We have the equation of motion. Let's just put some hats over those things. Yeah, well, it doesn't quite work this way. First thing is commutation relations of what with what in this. But then to quantize the Einstein equation is difficult for several reasons. For example, it is difficult to separate the curvature degrees of freedom from mere artifacts of the choice of coordinate system. Similar in electromagnetism. Some of you may have attended a course on quantum field theory for particle physics, in which you learn how to quantize, for example, the electromagnetic field. Now, the electromagnetic field has what is called gauge degrees of freedom. And it doesn't work to quantize the gauge degrees of freedom. It doesn't work to quantize the electromagnetic four vector, A mu, for example, just like that. You have to impose a gauge condition which removes the gauge degrees of freedom. And then you can quantize the remaining degrees of freedom, which are the physical ones. And here it's even more severe, because it's much harder to peel out the actual degrees of freedom from, for example, the metric or the curvature tensor. Also, if you look at this equation, this thing is a highly nonlinear equation in the metric. If you wanted to take, let's say, the metric and its time derivative and impose commutation relations between the two, this is nothing like the Klein-Gordon equation. You see, the Riemann curvature tensor contains powers of the gamma matrices up to the second power, if you remember. The Riemann curvature tensor is written in terms of derivative of the Christoffel symbols and squares of the Christoffel symbols. And then the Christoffel symbols are quadratic in the metric. And here's the metric again. So the whole thing is completely nonlinear here, which makes it very hard. So it's from the outset, it's a very highly self-interacting theory. In other words, whereas photons, which just propagate through another, gravitons don't. You may be lucky, and in some approximation they might do that. But that would be a very severe approximation where you throw away all the nonlinearities in there. In principle, you have to assume that the gravitational degrees of freedom are very strongly self-interacting. So far, all attempts to quantize gravity have run into severe difficulties, even when doing it perturbatively, essentially because there is no simple way of perturbing around something. There's no unique way of perturbing around something. In quantum field theory, there is a unique way of perturbing around the no field case. But in gravity, it's not very useful to perturb around the Minkowski space case because actual space-time is nowhere close to it. Even the presence of the moon or the sun will disturb that significantly, and then space-time is expanding and so on. And perturbation theory is very prone to violating covariance, so it's very hard. So what will we do in this course then? Well, initially, we will consider the case where there is a classical solution, g mu nu of x is known. So the space-time is given. The space-time and its evolution in time is a given. It's assumed to be a given. For example, a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space-time that expands with a certain rate and has a certain curvature, or perhaps is flat. And we will quantize only a field, Klein-Gordon field phi of x, that lives on that space-time. Much of our time in this course will be spent doing this. Assuming that the space-time is given, and we look at the quantization of a Klein-Gordon field that lives on it, and how particles are being produced, how quantum fluctuations are being enhanced, and so on. And then towards the end, we will also start quantizing the g mu nu itself, at least a little bit, perturbatively. Linear perturbations of the metric will be quantized as well. In fact, as it will turn out, some of the fluctuations of g mu nu are indistinguishable from fluctuations in phi because of the Einstein equation. You see, you can't just have fluctuations here and no fluctuations over there. It's just not consistent. So things hang together, and so fluctuations in the Klein-Gordon field, which lead to fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor, ought to be expected to be accompanied by fluctuations in the shape of the manifold as well. And that's what they will do. And then one of the problems will be to find a coordinate system independent characterizations of those fluctuations. Because there will be coordinate systems in which it looks as if the phi only is fluctuating and the metric stays. And there will be coordinate systems in which it looks as if just the metric is fluctuating and the phi stays constant. So we'll have to find a variable that captures the essence of it, which is composed of both the phi fluctuations and the metric fluctuations, and is something that is independent of the coordinate system. It sounds difficult, and it is, and it took some 15 or 20 years, and eventually papers in the literature converged on the right answer for this. Okay, now step C. We already differentiated the total action with respect to the other fields, electrons and quarks, and then dismissed that as irrelevant in cosmology. Then we differentiated the total action with respect to the metric and obtained the Einstein equation. And now we're differentiating the total action with respect to the Klein-Gordon field. Now, the Klein-Gordon field only occurs in the Klein-Gordon action. So really what we are requiring here is that the Klein-Gordon action differentiated with respect to phi is equal to zero. Now, let us look at the Klein-Gordon action. Here it is again. And I've put an arbitrary potential in there. Could be phi to the third, could be phi to the sixth, or whatnot. OK, so that was the Klein-Gordon action. And now we apply the Euler-Lagrange equation to it. Remember what that means, the Euler-Lagrange equation. See, why is that different from this? ds Klein-Gordon by d phi is equal to zero. And now I'm saying ds Klein-Gordon by d phi is not zero, but d by d mu of ds by f. How can both be right? That's right, and these are partial derivatives, that's right. So this is only differentiating with respect to the explicit occurrence of phi, and that's the derivative with respect to the occurrence of derivatives of phi. Okay, if you put that in there, then we obtain the Klein-Gordon equation in general relativity. It's just this. Maybe I'll leave it to you as an exercise to verify this little step there. Now, these terms, you can rearrange and make look a little bit nicer by putting them in this form. So what do we have then? We have that the Klein-Gordon field obeys this equation of motion if there is a potential of the form phi to the fourth. Here we have 1 over the square root of the absolute value of the matrix determinant, and it occurs over here as well. Space and time derivatives, the metric, and here is another derivative in phi. And here, this looks familiar. This would be the same on Minkowski space. But this thing is much more complicated. What would it be in Minkowski space? Well, in Minkowski space, it would be simply d mu d mu of phi. And it would be just the Dannenberg operator acting on phi, just d mu d mu of phi. Forget about this term and that term. Make this an eta mu nu, and you just get the second derivative. So really, this is a fancy second derivative operator. It is what is called the Dannenberg operator, and we denote it by the box. This is the full story of it. In principle, if somebody gives you a matrix-valued metric function, you can calculate what the Dannenberg operator is. Just calculate the determinant of the metric, get that from it, the inverse of the metric, get this from it, and then you can write down the Dannenberg operator. And once you have the Dannenberg operator, you can calculate the eigenfunctions of the Klein-Gordon equation, the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Well, and then what would you do? Just to spin this thought to the end. Well, then, once you have those, then you can calculate the energy-momentum tensor. See, the energy-momentum tensor is an expression in phi and its derivatives. Let's just back up a moment. Somebody gave you a metric. Somebody gave you a 4x4 matrix-valued function. Then you write down the Dannenberg operator from that, write down the Klein-Gordon equation, and solve it. And then you get phi as a function of space and time. Once you have that, you can calculate the energy-momentum tensor, this thing here. This thing here you can then calculate. Once you have that, which is, again, a symmetric matrix-valued function of space and time, you can put it in the Einstein equation, and then you have to hope. Because somebody gave you the metric already. And from that, you can calculate the Ricci tensor and everything. So you can calculate left-hand side. So you have to hope it actually works out. Okay? And in practice, what this means is that you really have to solve two simultaneous sets of equations. You have to solve the Einstein equation, which involves the metric, and through t mu nu, the Klein-Gordon field. And you have to solve the Klein-Gordon equation, which also involves the metric, namely inside the Dannenberg operator, and the Klein-Gordon field. So you have to solve for the metric and the Klein-Gordon field, in principle, always simultaneously. Well, here's the deal. The thing is that assume you have a Klein-Gordon field that's really dominating everything else, meaning its contribution to the energy-momentum tensor is really tremendous. Forget about the other contributions, that's just too small. And by that, I mean we've already solved the classical problem. Assume we solved the classical problem of solving the Einstein equation for a classical metric g mu nu and the classical Klein-Gordon field phi. So we've solved the Klein-Gordon equation and the Einstein equation classically in such a way that this thing comes out to be tremendously large, much larger than any other thing. So then we have already a classical solution, a full solution, because we really made the effort of solving both equations at the same time. Nothing's assumed here. You may do it perhaps iteratively, you know, assume one, calculate the other, correct for it back and forth, work with self-consistency. Maybe you can do that numerically or something. But in practice, you can actually do this. If you assume that there's enough symmetry in the space-time, then you have very few degrees of freedom. For example, if you assume that space-time is just spatially flat, there's only curvature between space and time left over as a variable. And then it's actually not too hard to solve classically both the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. There's still nonlinear equations, and we will get to them, of course, Friedmann equation and so on. But you can solve them. Now, to do the same thing quantum theoretically is virtually impossible. It's much too hard. Even gravity alone, we couldn't quantize, much less with the Klein-Gordon field. But what we can do is, we can say, well, let us look now at the quantum fluctuations of the field phi. So we write, I'm just anticipating what we will later do. Can't find chalk. Ah, here's some. So we can write the field phi as being some classical field phi that is very large, plus some small fluctuation of the field phi. The classical field phi, the classical Klein-Gordon field, may be very large in amplitude and maybe completely uniform, just the same everywhere. Why would it be that? Well, if we are looking at situations that are very symmetric, if we are looking at solutions where space is spatially flat and only curvature between space and time, which is to say expansion, can occur. In those situations, you would expect that this thing is constant. Because if space is flat, this thing should be spatially flat, it should be spatially constant as well, and only have a time variation, but not a space variation. This is a reasonable thing to do, and we will do it later. We will assume spatial flatness, spatial constantness there, constancy over there, and then say, well, but maybe there is a little bit of quantum fluctuations. Obviously, there should be. We should allow a field to have quantum fluctuations. Small ones. And then we can say, well, what if we just quantize this bit? What if we quantize just the deviation from that main Klein-Gordon field? So we leave the classical background, classical. It obeys the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gordon equation along with this. And then on top of that situation, we quantize small fluctuations of the Klein-Gordon field. It will turn out that along with that, we will have to quantize small fluctuations of the metric as well, just because they're coupled to the Einstein equation. But in this way, we avoid a problem here, namely having to quantize full gravity, which we cannot do. We will only have to quantize small perturbations of the curvature. See, by quantizing only the perturbations from the dominant phi, we only have to quantize the perturbations from the dominant shape of the manifold as well. And that's something that's doable. All right. Okay, so we arrived at the Klein-Gordon equation along with the Einstein equation. In principle, we'd like to solve both classically, and then the small perturbations from that solution that we find quantum mechanically. But how do we do that? How do we quantize now a field such as this field here, or really any field on a given background? How do we quantize that? Well, we arrived here today, and the next step will be to use the Legendre transform to identify the canonically conjugate variable to phi. Remember that it used to be phi dot, but that cannot be the answer in general, because depending on the coordinate system, phi dot could be many different things. So we'll use the Legendre transform to arrive at the Hamiltonian formalism. Then that means we have canonical pairs of variables. We impose the commutation relations, and that will get us to the quantized version within general relativity. But let me just spend a minute or two at the end on this step, just to give you an idea of of what's going on over there. So we could also do second quantization. We could also go to quantum field theory now using the path integral. Assume that a fixed space-time is chosen and that we're given its metric u mu of x in some arbitrary coordinate system. Our aim is to do the quantum field theory of fields living on that fixed space-time. So then for any fixed field, and by that I mean number-valued function, phi of x and t, we can then calculate its Klein-Gordon action. Remember, that's a real number. And it's this number there. And we know that it's the same number independently of what coordinate system we choose. The metric will always adapt so that this comes out to be the same number for any given field. Then following Feynman, we can turn this number, we can use this number to calculate what Feynman would have called a probability amplitude for this particular field phi of x and t to occur. Feynman would have said that the probability amplitude for that phi to occur is given by up to a normalization factor that is usually dropped and put in at the end, is e to the power of I over h bar times the Klein-Gordon action of the field phi. Now remember that we had, at the beginning of the course, we had covered the Schrödinger formulation of quantum field theory. And there we found a way to calculate probability distributions for finding fields. This is not the same. Absolutely not the same, because these are not really probability amplitudes. This is just a vague way of talking about a calculation that comes next. The reason is that the input into this is not a field as a function of space. This is a field evolution that goes into here. It is a function of space and time. So you're associating here what looks like a probability amplitude, not just to a field in space, but you're associating a probability amplitude to a field evolution, to a field and how it evolves in time. That's very different. It has nothing to do with what we did at the beginning in the Schrödinger picture. So it is as if you were placing yourself outside space and time and looking at the history of what is evolving. And to every history of a field, you assign a probability amplitude. Of course, that doesn't make sense probabilistically speaking. You can't take the mean value squared, the modulus squared of that thing and say it's a probability for a field evolution. It doesn't quite work that way. Now consider, for example, the vacuum expectation value of the product of two fields. That is going to be a quantity that will be very important. It's important in particle physics, but it's particularly important also in in cosmology. This is the correlator between fields, between the field at two different points, at the same time, but at two different points. So it's phi at x and phi at x prime. So it's the expectation value of this product. We know that this is fluctuating, and we know that that is fluctuating. If both are fluctuating completely independently of another, then when this happens to be positive, this has an equal chance of being positive or negative, which means that the expectation value is zero. Okay? If you take the expectation value of the product of two probability variables that have the same probability distribution, but are completely uncorrelated, then the correlation function, the expectation value of this product is zero. You see that? Just because if this is 5, this has an equal probability of being a positive number or the same negative number. Okay? If this is -3, well, this could equally be positive or negative. It's as many times positive as it is negative. It's as many times positive 10 as it is negative 10. Independent of what this does, if they are uncorrelated. And therefore, the overall expectation value of the product is zero. Quantum fluctuations are not like that. They are correlated. If the field at x is, let's say, positive for a moment, then the field at x prime is generally correlated with what the field at x does. It has a tweaked probability. It's like a rigged coin. It has an enhanced probability to be either positive or negative, depending on what this thing does, which means that there's a finite expectation value of this. The correlation between fluctuations, the way that one fluctuation here drags another fluctuation along with it, that's captured by calculating this in the operator framework, in the canonical quantization framework that we've used so far. You would calculate it simply by writing down the field operator at this point and the field operator at that point, and just calculate the expectation value of that product. For example, if the field is in a vacuum state, put it left and right, get the expectation value, and that's that number. But of course, for that to work, you have to identify what the vacuum state is, find the representation of the phi on that Hilbert space, and then work out what that is. We will later see exactly how to calculate this thing in cosmology using commutation relations. The point being that, the use of that being that, you can actually measure this thing in the sky. This is essentially telling you, through some intermediary plasma physics, what the probability is that if the sky is here a little bit hotter because of the cosmic microwave background radiation, that over there is a little bit cooler or a little bit hotter. This is the statistics, ultimately, that we see in the cosmic microwave background. Now, using Feynman's methods to calculate quantum field theory predictions, the way it would work is this. You get the same quantity up to a normalization constant that can be fixed by calculating what would be the expectation value again of the product of phi at x and phi at x prime. And here you have what, you know, could be called probability amplitude for a particular field evolution. And then you just sum over all possible field evolution. Sum over all possible field evolutions, the product of the field amplitudes multiplied with the probability that this particular thing actually occurs, that the particular field evolution phi actually occurs. And in this way, you get the same thing. And you can show in general that Feynman's method always gives you the same answer as the canonical method. It's just that in order to actually work this thing out, you have to overcome two problems. One is that it's terribly ill-defined mathematically because you're summing over all fields. It looks like you just have to do an integral, but you're summing over all fields, over all field evolutions, which at the very least means that you have to do an uncountable number of integrations. Namely, at every point, you have to allow the field phi to take an arbitrary value. And that makes it very ill-defined because it turns out that the non-differentiable phi contributes very much more than the differentiable ones in this path integral. These things can be overcome with regularization methods. But then you're still left with another problem, which is an ambiguity in the evaluation of that. I can't show you just yet how the ambiguity arises, but I will show you at the end of the course when we go in detail through the Feynman formalism. There's an ambiguity in there which cannot be resolved, at least as far as I know, cannot be resolved in general on curved spaces. It's just that this approach doesn't, as far as I know, doesn't tell you how to resolve that ambiguity. And that ambiguity is in one-to-one correspondence to identifying the vacuum state when you work with a canonical formalism. You see, here is no Hilbert space in all of this. There is no commutation relations and so on. But the ambiguity in finding the, in identifying the vacuum state in the canonical formalism has an analog in the Feynman formulation, and it looks as if it's much easier to resolve in the canonical formulation. And that's why we will go initially this way. We will not go the Feynman way here, which looks shorter, but we will go that way to the canonical formalism, identify the vacuum state, and do the quantization over there. And then at the end, we'll do that as well. Any questions? Yeah?
and bosons are different? Is that really different?
Well, all fields have different correlators. And fermions have different types of correlators than bosons have. But this is not, I mean, the main point, the main difference between the two is the commutator relation. Namely that bosons have commutators and simple to write commutators, and fermions have simple to write anti-commutators. But the correlators would be calculated in the same way. Another question? By the way, I made a few small changes, if you've noted, in the notes as compared to what was online yesterday. So you may want to reload the file later on and then put it online again. Okay, see you on Thursday.